Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, now offering 3 new Visa credit cards and 3 new checking accounts, with benefits that fit a variety of lifestyles and financial needs. More information is available at WSECU.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
The first time Carolyn Sofer laid eyes on her church's new home, she had a few second thoughts.
I came up and looked at it before he looked at it, and I said, ooh, I don't think we want that. That looks like a bus depot from Mississippi. So, because it didn't look anything. It was run down.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is Sound Effect, and we're in a storefront space in Skyway, just north of Renton, with co-pastors Carolyn and Menard Sofer.
It was something that you would never, ever want to. It was horrible, because this was like a tavern. And I won't even tell you all the paraphernalia that was on the walls. You can just imagine. And I'm just saying, a lady's eyes shouldn't behold all of this, you know. My kid said, Dad has lost his mind, because it was horrible looking. But he had a vision.
The black walls were painted white, the paraphernalia disposed of, and this den of sin was transformed into something a bit more wholesome.
This was a dance floor. Here, all the way back to that pole, that last pole back there, he had it cut back, and this became a perfect pulpit area.
But just because the dance floor was gone did not mean the music disappeared. In fact, the Sofers say their music was kind of what made this space into a church. This is what they call sacred steel, a gospel style centered around the lap steel guitar. It's specific to certain Pentecostal traditions, including the Church of God in Christ. Early in the 20th century, the mostly black churches often couldn't afford an organ.
Basically, they had was washpans, washboards, tambourines. They didn't have a chordal instrument, unless you found a piano, which they refer to as a piano. And many of those were out of tune, with broken strings. And so, being that the way it was, the guitar fit in because it was very mobile.
Now, Menard Sofer is teaching his son, also named Menard, to play the steel guitar. On Sundays, their son-in-law plays bass, everybody sings, and the storefront church is filled with the music of sacred steel. Today on Sound Effect, we take a look back at our favorite stories from 2018. Now we're going to hear one of our favorites from our City Slickers show that aired back in April. Rashina Fountain and Tiffany Adams met at Antioch University in Seattle, where they were both working for their master's degrees. Rashina grew up on the west side of Chicago. Tiffany is from downtown New York, and they quickly found they had a shared interest in nature. Before long, they were helping each other. Tiffany encouraged Rashina's newfound love of birding, and Rashina cheered Tiffany on in her studies. And that support was important, considering that birding is not the most obvious passion for a young African-American woman from a big city. They sat down together for a conversation in our studio. Tiffany kicked things off.
I grew up in New York City in the housing projects downtown, and I've always had an interest in wildlife and conservation. I just didn't really have the outlets to really pursue that growing up because it was very stressful. I grew up with my mom, and she struggled with addiction all my life. And so it was pretty stressful growing up in the projects and had to be mostly a caretaker at such a young age. And so like childhood and playing and having friends was like it didn't happen. And so through that experience, I had to find some type of peace and some type of escape. And for me, my way of connecting to nature was through National Geographic and Discovery Channel. And I always wanted to be the people taking pictures and the people in the Serengeti. And I'm just like, man, I want to do that. And I didn't see people who look like me, but I still wanted to be that. And so I started out birding, and I started out in Central Park, and that really awakened me to possibilities as far as career, and just awakened the passion that I had since I was little.
Can you talk a little bit more about that transition from National Geographic and then discovering birding as your passion?
I found a bird watching group that met in Central Park. And that first day I went, it was the height of migration, around mid-April. And I was the only black girl there. I didn't have any binoculars, no field guide. I just had my little point-and-shoot camera and my enthusiasm. What do people think you do in the environmental field? Family, friends?
Sure. I don't think my family really knows what I do. They know that I make a living and that I'm doing okay. I have an apartment. And so they know that. But in terms of, I heard my mom brag about me and my brother, because my brother, he has a master's degree in social work. And she was like, you know, I was telling my friends that my kids are doing well. You know, your brother has a master's degree in social work and you are doing something. You know, and so I don't think so. Yeah, so I have a master's degree as well. But she doesn't quite get the concept of like what I do. And I've tried to explain it and say, you know, I work in the environmental field. But, you know, she calls me her little hippie and thinks that I'm like maybe going on forest hikes every day or doing, I don't know what she thinks I do. But I think that that's, you know, part of the reason why I'm really drawn to being in the environmental field. Is because I want people from like cities. And, you know, my mom grew up in, you know, on the west side of Chicago, and her concept of like what nature is and what environmental field is scoped by the mainstream perception of what that is. And so when I say something about environment, she's picturing somebody chained to a tree, probably trying to save one tree or something like that.
You know, I kind of expect those comments. When I was little, I asked my mom, like, Mom, how come there's no black people studying animals? And my mom, she was like, oh, black people, we don't do that. We don't mess with animals. You know, I really thought about that. I mean, especially once I became a birder, I was like, wow, you know, this is not just for like retired white people, this is for everyone, you know? And so my thing is that representation is so important, because there's young kids out there that really want to do something that's different, that's out of the box. A lot of the kids out there need role models and people who look like them.
A lot of times there is a pressure to be a specific way. Into, you know, I'm a DJ, and I have been into hip hop. I write poetry and all. And at times, you know, I thought getting more serious in my career and getting more professional meant leaving those things behind. And that's one thing I was saying I admire about you, is that you're like, you're yourself. Like, no matter where you are, you bring your whole entire self. It's something that I think is important in terms of representation and being a black woman in the environmental field, and not muting any culture or anything like that in order to fit into a box, because then that negates people seeing themselves in me. And that's what I hope happens, that people can see themselves in me, because at times I was desperately looking to see myself in other people. And when I did, that motivated me, and that meant the world to me.
what would you say to the young Black girl who aspires to be an environmentalist but doesn't see much representation?
You know, that there's a first for everything, but luckily she doesn't have to be the first, because the more I got into the field, the more I said out loud what I wanted to do, I found that there were others, you know, that had already carved a path. So I think I would say you're not the only one with that passion, and to listen to that voice that you have that is telling you to follow that route. And you don't have to prove to anyone. You already have a right to be there. And it's not impossible, because there are others that have come before us. And so, yeah, I would say listen to that voice and follow your path. And, you know, it's already been carved for you.
Rasheena Fountain is a digital communications manager with the Environmental Leadership Program, and Tiffany Adams is a STEM instructor and a naturalist with Seattle Parks. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're listening back to our favorite stories from 2018. For this next story, we go back to our show on personal space. Patrick Haggerty is a gay man in his 70s, and one of the ways that he looked to claim that space was through music, country music. In the early 70s, as the gay liberation movement was taking shape, Haggerty and his pals cut an album in Seattle. It was called Lavender Country, and it's thought to be the world's first openly gay country album. He says it was provocative, but also good music, and still he didn't think that much would come of it.
It was hopeless to even consider anything like gay country in 1973. And besides, it was unabashedly radical. And so, other than have a good time with it ourselves, it had to die, and did.
Why country music?
There's two answers to that. One, why not? It's authentic, it's from the heart, it's American, it's familiar to a lot of people. Just because you're gay doesn't mean you can't be country. So that's the short answer. Buzz off, why not country? As good as any other genre. The second answer is, I'm not a seasoned, trained, go-to-college musician. I grew up at the mouth of the Owa River, west of Port Angeles. I'm a down-home dirt boy from a sharecropping, dairy farming family. And I did Lavender Country and chose that genre because it was the only kind of music I knew how to do.
Could you talk about some of the songs that were on the original album and what the inspirations were?
Back in the Closet Again is a song about how we as homosexuals had to kick our way into the labor movement, the women's movement, the movement for human rights and civil rights.
I'm back in the closet again.
And that we were unable to unite as a working class, and therefore the capitalists won.
Oh, I have to be alone because I'm sitting all alone.
Come Out Singing is just a gay liberation song about the joy of gay sex.
Waking up to say hip hip hooray, I'm glad I'm gay.
How was it received?
It put a scarlet letter on my chest. We knew that gay music in general was not going to be taken seriously by anybody except us. And I'd never sang in Nashville in this life. That turned out not to be true.
What gave you the courage to do something this new?
It came from my father. That's a whole big well.
Could we dip a bucket in that well?
We could. I don't believe in God, and I'm not much into religion, but something in the universe bestowed on me an absolutely ballerina, perfect, magnificent father for who I was and where I was headed. And he was disguised as a snuff-chewing, Farmer Brown pants-wearing, country bumpkin hayseed. My father saw who he had on his hands at a very early age, like 5. And in his mind, I was the child that God gave him to love. And by damn, he was going to do it some kind of way, because that was his job. And the way he taught me to take pride in myself was that he took pride in me. That's how that job is done. That wasn't an easy job for a kid who wore ballerina outfits at the 4-H camp and went to the Catholic Youth Organization talent shows in full drag. All kinds of things. I could sit in here and talk to you all day about what my dad said I could do. And I did, with impunity and glee and aplomb, my entire childhood. My father taught me to hold my head in dignity and go forth into the world with candor and forthrightness.
Do you remember how that came across to you? How that guidance came down to you as a kid?
One of the things that my dad said I had to do was win some scholarships so that I could get the hell up out of the valley, because I was never going to make it as a farmer. And it was a very serious job. Go get the job done. One of the things that you did to win a scholarship was run for student body office. And so I decided to run for pep promoter, which is essentially the head cheerleader. And I was on my way to school, and I was putting on my costume for the pep assembly, which consisted of a big lipstick smile from ear to ear, huge, several inches thick, with glitter all over my face. My brother was driving me to school. He said, "What the hell are you doing?" I said, "I'm putting on my costume." He was horrified. He called my father. He said, "You got to get up there. They're going to kill him. Go to the high school now." So I'm doing my campaign and running with the socialites, and here comes my father. And my father is wearing his clodhopper boots and his Farmer Brown pants with cow crop on them, and he's missing half of his teeth, and he looks like Pa Kettle, and I love him, and he's my dad, but I don't need Pa Kettle raining on my parade. So I ducked him. So we had the assembly and blah, 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 and I did my little spiel, and things are going great. So I'm riding home. My dad is taking me home because I have to start pitching bales. And he said, "I thought I saw a kid look just like you duck out on his dad when I walked down the hall this morning, but I knew it wasn't you because you'd never do that to your dad." And I said, "Dad, did you have to wear your cow crap pants to my pep assembly?" And he said, "Oh, I see. This isn't about what you were wearing. It's about what I was wearing. I get it. Look here, I'm a farmer. This is what I do. I don't have time to change my clothes just to run up to the high school to see what the hell is going on with you. I'm proud of who I am, and I'm proud of what I do. This is what I wear. Now let's talk about you. Were you proud of yourself with your lipstick smile and glitter on your face, all up and down to your ears? Were you proud of yourself?" And I said, "Well, I think I'm going to win the election." And he said, "I think you're going to win the election too, but it's not what I asked you. I asked you if you were proud of yourself." At this point, I'm not saying anything. And he said, you know I'm not well. I said, yes, Dad, I know. He said, you know I'm not going to be around when you're a full-grown man to help you with any of this stuff. You know that. And I said, yes, Dad, I know. And he said, well, I'm going to tell you something today and now. I'm going to tell you something now. And it might not mean anything to you now, but it will mean something when you get to be an adult. And I want you to promise me that you remember what I tell you. I said, okay, I promise. He said, who are you going to go out with at night when you go to the University of Washington Drama School? And I said, I don't know. And he said, I think you do know. Now listen up. Whoever you run around with at night, don't sneak like you did today. Because if you sneak, it means you think you're doing the wrong thing. And if you spend your life thinking you're doing the wrong thing, you'll ruin your immortal soul. So don't sneak, and remember it. I ask you, man, what sissy in 1958 in what hayfield in America got that from his father? Everybody else was getting the kicked out of him, being humiliated and disgraced, thrown out of the family, being beat up by their brothers. That's what was happening to country sissies in 1958. But it wasn't happening to me because of my father. He wouldn't do it, and he wouldn't allow anybody else to do it to me, and he wouldn't allow my brothers to humiliate me, and he wouldn't humiliate me, and he taught me not to humiliate myself. I was way ahead of the curve without even knowing it. So why did I write the world's first gay country album? My dad said I could.
So it took the world a little while to catch up to your dad, it seems. Fast forwarding back up to the early 70s after Lavender Country, you talked a little bit about some of the ways that it got kind of pushed to the margins. And what was that experience like for you?
Lots of people don't get recognized for their music, and that was fine. And that was where I was when somebody put one of my songs on YouTube, the song that we won't say over the radio.
You can if you want.
Oh, good. I have a song, and the name of the song is Crying These Sucking Tears. And if any song sunk Lavender Country for 40 years, it was that one. But 40 years went by, and somebody put Second Tears on YouTube, and I didn't know it because they don't do YouTube. And somebody else heard it and said, what is this? And they went to eBay and they found an old used vinyl for sale on one of my old Lavender Countries. And they bought it and they realized what it was. And I still don't know anything. And that person took it to a label, and the label called me on the phone, and I just about hung up on them because I knew it was an encyclopedia salesman, because nobody was going to be buying Lavender Country. But it wasn't an encyclopedia salesman, and it was really a label, and they reissued Lavender Country, and my life changed really fast. There's been 3 documentaries about Lavender Country. I did 2 live ballets of Lavender Country music in San Francisco. There's a feature-length movie being made about Lavender Country right now. So it's great to have all this acknowledgement, go down in history and all that, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, okay, it's an ego trip. But I made Lavender Country as a statement in 1973 to transform society through political organizing. So now I have the opportunity And also the revolutionary obligation to use Lavender Country for what I made it for in the first place. So that's a real bottom line joy. And the other bottom line joy is that I get to take my father with me into history, and I get to acclaim his contribution to this movement.
Patrick Haggerty's father, Charles, died in 1961. Today, Haggerty lives with his husband in Bremerton. His album, Lavender Country, is archived in the Country Music Hall of Fame.
There's nothing left but holes in your weary sexist roles. Time to trade them old PJs for goodwill negligee.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, this is Sound Effect, and today we're taking a look back at some of our favorite stories from 2018. This next story came from our Gray Area episode. Our legal system can be a pretty confusing mashup of contradictions and balancing acts. And in order to sort through all this and find some clarity, we depend on judges. Judges make judgment calls, and sometimes those calls are not so popular. Well, one of these cases happened in Seattle in 2013. Seattle Times reporter Christine Claridge covered the case. It was a guy who could have been held on bail, but was instead released and then was accused of going out and committing a rape. It seemed like the judge had blown it. And that's probably what you'd conclude from Claridge's article, but the truth was not so simple.
I got a tip from someone in the criminal justice system that a defendant who had been set free by Judge Kessler had gone on to sexually assault and kidnap a woman within the same week of being released. His name is Ricky Lee Lewis. He had been convicted of statutory rape in 1985 and forcible rape in 1993. He served 10 years, and then he was wanted on a warrant for failure to register as a sex offender, which is not a violent crime. It's not a sex crime. It's sort of a administrative crime. I started reporting it. I called Judge Ron Kessler.
My name is Ronald Kessler. I am a retired King County Superior Court judge.
He was the person who made the decision about whether to let this defendant, Lewis, go. And he called me back.
And I said to her, well, I was sorry I was wrong in terms of predicting his behavior in the future, which is what I sort of had done. But at the time, I did what I thought was the right thing to do. I followed the law, and that was essentially the conversation.
I wrote down what he said. I put it in the story. I thought I was even-handed and fair in my reporting and writing. Then I went to bed, and the next day everything kind of blew up.
The next morning, Saturday morning, I picked up my Seattle Times, and there was this picture of me and Ricky Lee Lewis on the front page, our two mugshots, and above the fold was the story that the judge admitted he was wrong in releasing this guy. That was me. It was essentially, you read the story, and it was blaming me in part for the new crime he was alleged to have committed.
The story was very well read and commented on and shared, and people were furious at the judge. There were a lot of comments that called him something like a weasel or urged people to not vote him in, to remember his name at election time and kick that louse out. I didn't look at the story in print until after I got an angry phone call. It was Judge Kessler, and he left a message using all kinds of bad language. He really did kind of curse me out and indicated that he was extremely unhappy with the story.
I wasn't happy, but I did not curse.
I called him back. One of the things he said was that, my God, you've got my picture right next to the perp, right under the headline. It looks like we're both suspects. He wasn't happy. My stomach just sank. It really did.
I felt bad that someone was apparently raped. I had been the one who released him, but a judge can lock everybody up and keep them in jail forever or for as long as possible. That's the easy way out, but then that's not what we get elected to do. We get elected to exercise discretion and make decisions. Under the law from the Supreme Court of Washington, there's a presumption of release for people who are charged with a nonviolent offense. And when people are released, some of them are going to commit crimes. We recognize that.
So we talked for a while, and really there wasn't, I mean, the paper's already printed, and it wasn't incorrect. It was truly what he said, and I couldn't do anything with the facts of that story because they were true.
So she asked me, what can I do? And I thought for a moment, and I invited her to sit on the bench with me at an arraignment calendar and see what I do.
When I went into it, I had no idea what the story would be like. Arraignment court is set off and it's glassed in because sometimes there's so many emotional things happening. It's filled with attorneys, it's filled with court personnel and the guards with their guns and the clerk and the bailiff, and then they said, all rise, and he walks out in his black robes.
And she followed right behind me. I had two chairs on the bench.
All the attorneys looked like, who is that lady? He didn't explain anything. He just let them wonder. And the defendants come in one by one, and the judge hears their case.
A certain defendant.
George Peffers, I think, was his name.
He walked in the door, just like Ricky Lee Lewis did. He was charged with failure to register as a sex offender. I have information regarding the alleged offense. I have access to prior offenses and what that was all about.
His fingers are flying as he's, like, looking up the past court cases, what the decisions have been made.
I have access to their failure to appear rate. I mean, how often did somebody fail to appear in court when they were ordered to do so? This is all information that I take into consideration in making the decision on every single case.
So the prosecutors asked for $30,000 bail, which is their usual amount. And the judge, one of the things they said is, oh, he has no address, he has no this, he doesn't have that. And the judge said, well, you obviously know where he is because you sent a warrant and he showed up.
And I released him, and she whispered to me and said, well, I guess you had to let him go. And I said, yeah, that's right, I did. A week or two later, there was another story in the Seattle Times, a longer story, above the fold again, with friendlier pictures of me in the courtroom, and it was a really good story. It was fair. It showed what I did every day. It showed what judges do every day.
Well, you know, I've always been grateful. Thank you for letting me do that. I mean,
how did your folks at the Times react to that article?
They loved it. I think it won a prize.
Did it win a prize?
Yeah.
Oh. I didn't get a part of that prize.
Nothing happened. They just said my
oh,
name.
Oh, you win a prize. Was, okay.
Judge Kessler is very unique in that, very unusual for a judge to ever let you get that close to them. They're wary of the press for good reason. I think after the first story ran, people were basically like, that's why you don't talk to the press.
That's correct.
Never speak to the press.
That's what my colleague said.
This is
what
you
get.
Because
I've been telling them, you should be talking to the press more so that the public knows what it is we do accurately.
What did they say after the second one?
I got a standing ovation at a judge's meeting.
When I write stories now, I'm more aware of the kind of effect they might have. I try to look at the headline now. I try to look at the placement. And I will often try to include a paragraph that describes what the state law is regarding bond. And the law is that people are presumed innocent and that they are supposed to be let go unless prosecutors can show legitimate evidence that they shouldn't be.
I mean, it's a conflict in the Constitution because I mean, these folks are presumed innocent, but also the Constitution provides, in some circumstances, that there can be pretrial detention, which of course is inconsistent with the presumption of innocence. But that's what we've got.
Yeah, that's why you have judges.
That was retired King County Superior Court Judge Ron Kessler and Seattle Times reporter Christine Claridge. Sound Effects' Jennifer Wing produced that story. But before we move on, Judge Kessler gives us one last twist, how the guy accused of rape ultimately landed in another gray area.
Okay, what ultimately happened to Ricky Lee Lewis is that the defense investigated the case, came up with mitigating evidence that had raised doubt as to the victim's claim. She had lied about how she met him. It wasn't a stranger rape. It doesn't mitigate the rape at all, but it makes it a lot more difficult for the prosecutor to prove when a witness, their victim, will have to admit on the stand before the jury that she had lied about part of what occurred. The prosecutor reduced the charge substantially to, I believe it was burglary with sexual motivation. He pleaded guilty, and far from life without parole, he was sentenced to 7 years in prison.
You're listening to Sound Effect, Gabriel Spitzer here, and today we're giving another listen to some of our favorite stories from 2018. When you are a big person, society seems to send these relentless messages that you take up too much space. So there's something really refreshing about feeling small. Well, one way to get that feeling is to appreciate the vastness of the world, the way you do on a good hike. But as Sound Effect contributor Bethany Denton explains, getting out into nature can be a challenge.
I think it can sometimes feel like there's no room for fat people in the outdoors. I say this as a fat person. In fact, a fat person who grew up in a very outdoorsy community outside of Glacier National Park in Montana. As a kid, I hiked and skied and rafted like most people do out there. But as I got older, and as I got fatter, hiking trips became less frequent. Mostly by choice, since I was almost always the slowest one holding up the rest of the group. But as a teenager, I often witnessed friends making plans for this hike or that backpacking trip. Plans peppered with different excuses as to why it was probably for the best that I didn't come along. You really need to be sure-footed for this trail. You know, stuff like that. After a while, even short hikes seemed out of my league. And so I would say things to my friends like, "Please, you think this hikes?" while gesturing to my body. We'd all laugh. And later I would imagine them on the trail, scaling the last 1,000 feet of elevation, the viewpoint in sight. I imagine their exhaustion, their sore muscles and sweaty backs, and their euphoria when they reached the top. I'm not going to speak for all fat people, but what I will say from my experience is that for me, the danger of being fat is not the physical limitations. The danger of being fat for me is the resignation. Thoughts that begin with, "I could never," or "I'm not the kind of person who could blank until I lose weight." And so I told myself for years that I hated the outdoors, all while daydreaming about how amazing it must be to be in the woods or up on a mountain, without judgment or fear of my body failing me. So when I discovered the group Fat Girls Hiking, that's what it seems. You can imagine my excitement.
Is there, everyone's here?
Yes, I think so.
Everyone's here. Great. Fat Girls Hiking is a body positive outdoor community based in Portland, Oregon. So just like any type of movement-based activity that seems intimidating, we try to do together.
You use the word intimidating. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think that a lot of fitness places are intimidating for fat people because, the motivation, I think, for a lot of people going to fitness places is weight loss. And that's not my motivation at all. For doing any type of movement, it's mostly mental health, and it just feels good.
My goal is never. Summer, the group's founder, started Fat Girls Hiking back in 2015. When I asked Summer how the group got started, she told me it began as a joke between her and her girlfriend at the time.
I was dating someone who would just like surprise me with hikes. She would just be like, "Let's go for a drive," and I'd be like, "Cool." And then we'd go for a drive, and she'd be like, "Hey, we're gonna walk to this waterfall," and I'd be like, "Okay." And then it would be like a 4-mile hike, and I'd be like, "I'm wearing fashion boots that like are not good for a wet trail." And then, so one day we're on this trail and we're just like, God, everyone just felt like everyone was looking at us. Like, what are these fat girls doing hiking, you know? We were just like laughing about it, like, yeah, we're fat girls and we're hiking, you know? And we just like, just totally like making fun of ourselves. And then it just became a thing. I just started an Instagram and it was just like, yeah, that's how it started.
There is one rule in fat girls hiking. No one gets left behind.
It makes me so mad when I hear that people go on group hikes and they get left behind. But that's the common experience, right? You have to be able to keep up or you'll get left behind. That's how it's always been, you know? Like, when you're in school and you have to, like, run the mile. I was always the last person. I loved running. But I got so shamed for being the last person that I stopped doing it because it wasn't fun to feel like shit about being the last person.
I met up with Summer and a group of other fat girl hikers on a typical December morning. There were 7 of us that day. 9, if you count the 2 dogs on leashes. We met at Carkeek Park in northwestern Seattle. The sky was overcast and gray all day. The trails were muddy with recent rains, and the salty smell of the Puget Sound was heavy in the air. Our only goal was to make it to the beach.
And that's our trail right there.
And as happens in groups of people with similar bodies, we talked about our bodies.
Has anyone here ever had trouble buying like outdoor or athletic clothes?
Oh, yeah.
It's impossible to buy athletic clothes as a larger woman. They don't make them.
This is one hiker, Marley Blonsky.
It's really, really frustrating. Like, for example, right now I'm wearing Target yoga pants, which are really not functional for hiking. It's just, we need functional clothing. Like, we hike, we bike, make clothes for us. We'll buy them.
Yeah, I remember.
We eventually came to a trestle that crossed a train track and led down to the beach. A murder of crows danced happily above us, and the sky glowed that strange yellow-gray that happens when the sun is behind thick layers of clouds. As we walked, another hiker, LaMonica Washington, told me about a time when she went to a snowshoeing class with a friend. Before the class even started, LaMonica and her friend both noticed other people in the class staring at her.
You know, it was just kind of a weird experience. Even my friend, he's a tall, thin, white guy, even he sensed that people were like prejudging me. Mm-hmm. I mean, and if he can sense that, then you know something's there. He was like, I just don't understand why everybody's looking at you. I don't think it's because you're black. It's because he was like, there's 2 black guys here and a lot of Asian people here. I just don't understand. And I was like, well, you gotta look around again. I'm the fattest person here. Everyone yeah. else here is, you know.
Yeah.
It's eye-opening, you know. Fine. Yeah. When they can see you actually being like stereotyped mm-hmm. without even knowing your drive, you know, your goals or you know your ambition, you know, assuming that you have no business being here.
I know that look that LaMonica is talking about. All of us fat girl hikers do. There's something happening with fat people online, especially on Instagram, which is where I discovered fat girls hiking in the first place. I keep seeing profiles of fat people living life without trying to lose weight. There's this idea that being fat doesn't mean you're not healthy, just as being thin doesn't mean that you are. And it might seem like a small thing, just deciding to be fat, an inaction rather than an action. But for me and for other fat girls hiking, deciding to live a healthy life that doesn't center around weight loss is revolutionary.
Because I think a lot of people say this, I've heard this a lot through fat girls hiking, like, oh, well, I'll do that hike when I lose this amount of weight. And I'm just like, why have that be a barrier for yourself? Why not just do it now? It's like a freedom to, like, have all this space. I can kind of take up as much space as I want. Being around, like, you see, like, a huge tree, you're like, no one's like shaming this huge tree for being big. This tree is beautiful because it's big. And thinking about things like, you're actually really insignificant in the world. When you are next to the ocean, you just realize how small you are. And that's just like, to me, that's like, that kind of perspective is the most beneficial thing.
Near the end of the group hike, I started talking to Kelsey Esquinas.
for me to like experience nature and its grandeur is like more healing or like more valuable to my life than the actual fitness part.
Yeah.
So there's this song that kind of, I think, like encompasses it. It's by Kimya Dawson. Do you know who that is? It's called I Like Giants. It basically says like, you're smaller than a speck of dust in a giant's eye. And I feel like when you go to the mountains or like when you see that type of stuff, like that is so visually representative.
I'm getting a little emotional because that's one of my favorite songs.
Oh, that's like, awesome. That makes me so happy.
Yeah. And it's not really a very...
We all packed up and met each other out for lunch at a Central American restaurant. No one said anything about calories or bad foods. Plates were passed around. We all tried each other's meals. And Kelsey gave me a ride home. And along the way, she switched on Kimya Dawson. And we both sang along to one of our favorite songs. Rock and roll is fun, but if you ever hear someone say you are huge, look at the moon, look at the stars, look at the sun, look at the ocean and the desert and the mountains and the sky, cause all girls feel too big sometimes, regardless of their size. Say I am just a speck of dust inside a giant's eye.
Bethany Denton lives in Seattle, where she helps produce the podcast Here Be Monsters. Just inside a giant's eye, and I don't want to make her cry, cause I Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestedt, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. We got help this week from Max Wasserman and Bethany Denton. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. Why don't you make one of your New Year's resolutions to subscribe to our podcast? You can find it anywhere you get your podcasts, and we would really appreciate it if you would rate and review the show while you're there. You can also tell your smart speaker to play Sound Effect, the podcast. And hey, got a story idea? We love to hear those. Send them to soundeffect@knkx.org. We'll see you in the new year when our theme is Let's Eat. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.